Kevin Costner actually took over for the composer and wrote the score.
He probably did. Actually, Edward Norton did. You didn't realize that. Edward Norton took over.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
You punch it at 8:30 every morning, except you punch it at 7:30 following a business holiday, unless it's a Monday, then you punch it at 8 o'clock. Punch it late, and they dock it!
Hello!
Hey.
Hello, everybody. This is Recotopia, episode 33. The big recommend today is the Hudsucker Proxy. Hello, I'm Chris Atkinson.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Scott.
And hello to all of you out there on Twitch and YouTube currently watching us live on a Tuesday, several days before this podcast is released to the public. I hope everybody enjoyed watching this. This is probably my 15th time watching the Hudsucker Proxy. So, this was right up my alley, obviously. Once Jeremy suggested it, I was like, yeah, I'll watch that movie again. Why not? I have watched it many, many, many times. So how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk about movies today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, do you have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Oh boy, do I. I saw this movie on Hulu called Not Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This movie stars Zoe Deutsch and Dylan O'Brien and Mia Isaac. Mia Isaac I had never seen before, I don't believe. Have you seen this?
I have not.
Okay. This Mia Isaac girl is incredible. She's going places. So this is a black comedy, a sharply satirical movie about a girl who basically is fame-seeking. Zoe Deutsch is amazing in this movie. She works at a magazine. It's actually a blog called Depravity. So it's kind of aping stuff like the Daily Beast or Vulture, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it opens with her pitching the editor on an article. You find out later she's not a writer. She's a photo editor. But she's in the office of the editor pitching an article about how much life experience she's missed because she wasn't in the States for 9/11. And she was abroad, and then everybody else has all this trauma, the shared grief experience. And the editor's like, I think we want to avoid any kind of FOMO about 9/11.
Right.
And so he goes, can't Tone Deaf be like a brand? Isn't that what Lena Dunham does?
Oh, God.
And she has a guinea pig named Guinea Weasley. Dylan O'Brien works at the blog, but he's the influencer writer, and he's become an influencer himself, and he's constantly blowing ginormous clouds of vape smoke everywhere, and he's really, really funny in this movie. She has a huge crush on him. She bumps into him and tells him that she got invited to a writer's retreat in Paris, and she just makes it up. It's a complete lie. And he's like, oh, awesome. I'm going to follow you on Instagram so I can see all your pictures. And she's like, okay, crap. What do I do now? And she's like, oh, yeah, I'm a photo editor. I'm going to start making Photoshops that make it look like I'm in Paris. And she starts to get a little bit of a following because he follows her back and comments. And then there's a terrorist attack right at the place where she says she's staying in Paris, a bombing. And so she decides to co-opt that event and play up that she's a survivor of the Paris
my God.
Terrorist attack. She goes to a support group. That's where she meets the Mia Isaac character, who's a real survivor of a school shooting.
Mm-hmm.
She tries to become a surrogate big sister to this girl, all while just making up lie after lie after lie. I went to look at the reviews after I saw this movie. This is on Hulu with a regular subscription. It's a Hulu original. And it's like a 73 on Rotten Tomatoes. And I read through some of the negative reviews, and they had a recurring theme that was that this character is completely unlikable. Why are we following her?
Mm-hmm.
That's the entire point of the movie. Mm-hmm. She even ends up, after she's exposed, she ends up at a support group for people who have been shamed online, trying to get pity from these people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the girls next to her says, "You're just a rich white girl who still thinks she's the main character."
Mm-hmm.
And that is the point of the movie.
Yeah.
That she's not the main character. Neither are you. Neither am I. None of us are. I loved this movie.
Mm.
It goes on the back of Zoe Deutsch, who I already love from Flower, a couple other movies. She's mm-hmm. a tremendous talent. But Dylan O'Brien is surprisingly hysterical in this movie. If anything that I've said sounds intriguing to you, give this a look. I think you would enjoy this. But just know going in, she's a terrible person.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the point.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Zoe Deutsch. Was it Everybody Wants Some was the first time I saw her. And then she has a scene-stealing performance in Zombieland 2.
Yes, she does.
So I've always liked her as well.
There's a scene where she goes to the influencer guy, Dylan O'Brien's having an influencer party. And when she's leaving, she gets a goodie bag like you would at the Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
And as she's walking home later, she has this like fake, "I'm going to do a good deed." And she like hands it to this homeless lady on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the homeless lady looks through the bag and goes, "Man, what the fuck am I supposed to do?" And it cuts right away to the next scene.
Nice.
It's a very funny movie. I got to remember who made this because she made something else that you've seen. Sorry, this is good radio. The Quinn Shepherd is the director.
Mm.
And she made, God Friended Me. She made The Miseducation of Cameron Post with Chloe Moretz. And I think those were the two I was thinking of. But there you go. There's my first small recommend. Ran a little over on that because I was enthusiastic.
I will probably end up watching that at some point. I do like those dark comedies. I watched in theaters the sequel already to X called Pearl. The story behind that is fairly well known, I think, at this point. They went out to shoot X, I believe, in Australia, and while they were having while they were being quarantined, Ty West FaceTimed with Mia Goth and said, "Hey, you want to make another movie while we're out here, since, you know, we've got the equipment already out here and we've got, you know," and they FaceTimed the script for this movie before the other one even got shot. And then they got it greenlit and everything.
What a
world. So this is the sequel to X, and the first time I watched X, I was like, don't know if I'm totally on board with this. The second time I really liked it. This movie is better than X, I think. If you have watched X, you know that there's a creepy old woman played by Mia Goth in a double role. She plays a young woman on a porn set, and she plays the old lady in the movie as well. This is that old lady back in World War I, World War II days, somewhere around there. She's living with her parents. Her husband has gone off to war. Her mom is very, very strict, wants her to always be around because the father has some sort of affliction, where he's barely there anymore. He can't speak. They have to bathe him. They have to do all these different things. And Pearl seems like, you know, someone who's just kind of going through the motions, but she's got a dark side to her. You find this out pretty quickly. But even with that dark side, you think, basically she's still a very good person. When she goes out to town to get medicine for her father, She often likes to stay around and watch movies while she's at it. So she watches this movie. It's a bunch of dancing and stuff like that, and gets out of the movie. And you get the sense this is finally who she kind of gets to be herself a little bit more, because she's not back at home and all that. She's smoking a cigarette in the alley, and projectionist comes out and says, "Hey, you should come back here more often," you know, that kind of thing. Where, I can show you any movie that you want, you know, that type of thing. And it's, you know, it's not nearly as skeezy as I make it sound, but it's pretty skeezy. and so she sort of takes him up on it and finds out that he has dreams of going to Europe and shooting these kind of porn pictures that nobody's really seen yet before. She shows him one that's already been made, and it's one of these, you know, like, I can't believe they made stuff like this back in this day and age or whatever, this silent, like, porno thing. And I'm trying to figure out, the only one thing I'm trying to figure out is if Ty West shot his own and made it look like it was old, or if it was one of those, if it's like a real one that they found or whatever. That's how realistic it looks on screen. But as the movie progresses, you can tell that there's something a little damaged about Pearl. Just a little bit damaged. And we know this from early on, but we don't know how far damaged it is until it gets further into the movie and you realize that she will do anything to get off of this farm, and she doesn't want to be around her parents anymore. And she is very slowly getting to the point of, like, she feels like she's backed into a corner. I won't go any further because there's a lot of, you know, things to be revealed about this, but you can tell that this was a big collaboration with Ty West and Mia Goth, and they really sank it into this character. And it's a better, I think, yeah, like I said, it's a better movie than X. They're going to have a sequel to X. Starring Mia Goth. Well, that comment, I was about to read the comment. Let's see. Where was it? Where's that comment? Oh, yeah. Tatsuka says, "Pearl is better than X, huh? Well, X gon' give it to you." There you go. I highly recommend Pearl. I think you will, Jeremy especially, love Pearl. I think you saw X. I don't know what you thought of X, but...
Finally saw and enjoyed X.
Yeah, I think you will like this more.
Except for the part where that dude plays Landslide perfectly. I don't understand how you can think you can get away with that. Anyway, yeah. I'm very interested in Pearl and also Max Axaxine, however they're going to...
Yeah.
I guess it's just Maxine.
Yeah,
with three
just be
X's
Maxine,
in.
Yep.
I'll have to check it out. I'm going to recommend a movie that, let me double check, I'm pretty sure is a 39 on Rotten Tomatoes, but a 6.6 on IMDb.
Hmm.
And this is a movie that, frankly, most people I don't think have seen. It's Bill Murray in The Man Who Knew Too Little.
Ah, yes.
Which is after his run of What About Bob and Groundhog Day. And this is in his string of misses, with, like, Larger Than Life. And this is a movie where he's just a dumbass American, goes over to London to visit his brother who lives and works there. His brother doesn't have time for him, has a big important meeting, buys him this essentially like a game night type experience where he gets to play the role of a spy and run all throughout London and have all these other actors give him this great experience. And just like in Game Night, which I'm now realizing kind of ripped this movie off in concept, he accidentally gets embroiled immediately in real criminals and real crime.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen this?
Yeah, I saw it when I worked at a theater that had this movie, and I watched it then. That's the last time I saw it, though.
Yeah, there's a scene where he's trying to escape a hotel room, and he's on the ledge, and they're shooting at him, and he tries to call time out because he thinks he's in an acting show, and one of them shoots again, and he's like, "I said time out, you jack-off!" and then there's a scene later after that where there's a bunch of Russian dancers doing a formal Russian dance, and he ends up in costume on the floor doing the dance with everybody. And of course, it's hysterically bad.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say this movie is good, but I can say I like it and I laugh at it. And I've seen it maybe three or four times. It's, of course, riffing on The Man Who Knew Too Much in title.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much that's the only thing it has in common with that movie.
Yeah.
But it's got Peter Gallagher in it, Joanne Whaley, who I haven't seen in forever. Alfred Molina's in it. And if you like Bill Murray, and if you like the comedies that he made in the 90s, I would tell you to watch this one. It's on Hulu with a regular subscription. And I think it's good.
I remember enjoying this quite a bit. I didn't think it was because it was in that period of time with all those bad Bill Murray movies. So I was not expecting much when I saw it. But yeah, I remember liking it quite a bit, actually. So
yeah.
So a little bit of a left turn. I'm going to recommend a YouTube channel.
Ooh.
This YouTube channel is called Fact Fiend. Ooh. And it's got everything that you want from sort of a like behind the scenes type of research show. And I think it does YouTube well, although they've recently been struggling and there's a big story behind that. But the guy's name is Carl Smallwood. He's basically in front of a camera in front, with a green screen behind him. And he just talks about some subject, usually pop culture. There's one about Seven he does where he's talking about how the script that David Fincher got was not the script that the studio wanted him to get. So when he came in to talk about the movie with the studio was like, oh, yeah, and by the end of Seven, when there's the car chase and blah, 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 David Fincher was like, what car chase? I didn't see a car chase in this. And he was already, David Fincher was already kind of like pissed off at this point, with studio filmmaking, was almost considering quitting because of Alien 3. And now he's going into the Seven where he's got a script that he loves and the studio's saying, oh, there's this car chase at the end of Seven. So anyway, Carl Smallwood sits here and tells you the whole story of like the ending of Seven and how that ending ended up actually making it into the movie and so on and so forth. And he does this with a lot of pop culture things. I remember referring to this a long time ago. He was talking about Ready Player One and he said some friend gave him Ready Player One to read. And he was like halfway through it. And he was like, so what's the twist? And the guy's like, what twist? I was thinking maybe that the twist would be that the guy that we're reading this whole time is really the bad guy of this book because he's such an asshole all the way through it and everything. And apparently that's not it at all, you know, whatever. But, whenever you see a YouTube channel where it's just basically him talking to somebody off camera and saying, did you ever hear the story of this? And they're like, no, I didn't hear that. And it's like a back and forth. And it's like, it builds this sort of like community kind of thing, you know, where, you know, you're watching this thing about pop culture that you've never heard about before. And this guy really goes deep into the research of it and like really gets out a lot of the facts and everything. And it's really fun to watch. And I think you guys out there would really, really love Fact Fiend. If you want to get a new YouTube channel in your life and you love pop culture, you obviously do because you're listening to us right now. So give it a whirl, man. It's fun stuff. It's really fun.
Yeah. That sounds awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I love that. Over the course of this show, we've recommended so many different kinds of things, like video games and recipes and YouTube channels and TV shows. I think that's kind of the spirit of the whole show.
Huh? Yeah, absolutely. So,
All right. Are we ready for the big recommend?
I think the big recommend is ready to go.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
It's the Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah.
I too have seen this movie probably 15 times, but I had not seen it in about 8 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the perfect amount of time for me to rediscover the joys of this movie. Mm-hmm. I was grinning ear to ear the entire time I watched this movie because it's just so fun from that zoom through the city with that opening narration talking about 1958 and the rat race and finally coming up on Tim Robbins and then saying, well, basically, let's go back and find out how we got ourselves here. It just, it's like a storybook on film. And I really like that quality. It's almost visually Tim Burton-esque at times.
Mm-hmm.
I think, at least in terms of some of the set design.
It's definitely a kind of an otherworldly feel to it. It doesn't feel like a big city building, really. It's just, it does feel, it feels like you're on a set, but like, I don't know. It does have that Tim Burton kind of feel to it.
I know exactly what you're trying to say there. So we have Norval Barnes as our main character. This is Tim Robbins. The producer, Joel Silver, wanted Tom Cruise. Imagine the movie if that had happened. Tim Robbins' height actually works to his advantage in this movie in terms of some of the physical comedy that he does and some of the juxtaposition between him and other characters. He gets off the bus from Muncie, Indiana. And let me tell you, I've been to Muncie, Indiana probably 30 or 40 times. Mm-hmm. I used to live very near Muncie, Indiana. And he's fresh out of the Muncie School of Business, College of School of Business, whatever the hell they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to get a job, only all the jobs require experience. So he has to start at the bottom, at the mailroom, at the Hudsucker Industries building. And this is probably one of the most famous scenes from this movie, as his boss walks him through the mailroom, barking out all the rules, telling them that, and they dock you if he messes up any of it.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, people are constantly giving him packages and envelopes and things to carry and saying, this has to be on the 8th floor by midnight. And he just being bombarded with information.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a really classic scene. I think we've used it in videos a dozen times. Mm-hmm. And they dock you.
Yep.
Well, he's got an idea. After his coffee cup leaves a circle on his newspaper,
mm-hmm.
he's got an idea. And so he draws it on a piece of paper. And when he gets his opportunity, which is a blue letter. The blue letter introduction is hysterical because everybody wigs the fuck out everywhere they go. Like even the elevator guys, like making all this chit-chat and Jesus, Mary, Joseph, is that a blue letter? The blue letter has made this ominous, ominous thing, and it's a Chekhov blue letter that the movie makes you forget completely until it brings it back, and it's perfection. So he goes up with this blue letter to Paul Newman's office, which was almost Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Paul Newman is Sidney Musburger. Now, he's the acting president. The president of this company has jumped to his death after a really, really good financial report from the board. He runs down a really long boardroom table and goes out the window and all mm-hmm. the way down. And so now they're looking for a patsy. They're looking for a proxy. They're looking for a doofus,
mm-hmm.
somebody that they can control to name as acting president. And they want to tank the stock because then they'll be able to buy it. They can't afford to buy the stock. And the dead Hudsucker, founder of the company, his stock is going to hit the public market January 1st or something. And so they want to tank the company's stock so that they can afford to buy most of it and then go back to doing business as normal, and then they'll be rich. That's the scheme. There's a hilarious bit of physical comedy when Tim Allen is in Paul Newman's office with a fire and a water cooler and a trash can. And all throughout the process, he proves to Paul Newman that he is exactly the idiot he's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But he does get to share his idea, and it's for a circle, you know, for kids.
Mm-hmm.
It takes nearly a third of the movie before we find out that that is a hula hoop that he has designed. And hilariously, there are two more designs that are an exact circle that we see later in the movie for two completely different well-known products.
Yep.
And of course, the hula hoop, after initial struggles, is a massive success. There's an amazing scene where nobody buys them, so the store owner throws them out, and this one little kid finds it and picks it up. It actually stops right at his feet, and he's the hula hooping wizard.
Mm-hmm.
All the kids get out of school, and they're running around the corner, and they see him and stop, and they're all amazed, and then suddenly, hula hoops are everywhere, and the stock is not tanking. It's going up. All the while, we have Jennifer Jason Leigh. She works for the local newspaper, and she's been sent in undercover to try and get the scoop at the company. And she writes an article early on about him being a big doofus, and he doesn't know that his new secretary is also the woman author of these articles that are criticizing him. She gives an incredible performance in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
She claims to be from Muncie herself. There's a hilarious scene where he does the fight song from the school, and she pretends to know it and try and keep up with him. And of course, he's an idiot. He doesn't realize. but eventually she falls for him. And then after she falls for him, as he starts letting the success go to his head and starts becoming an asshole, she calls him on it. At this point, he's got a four-piece orchestra in his office, cucumbers on his eyes. There's a sculptor in the corner making a sculpture. I just love all the visual pops of this movie. Like even the offices where Paul Newman's got one corner of the clock, the big clock on the building,
mm-hmm.
in the background of his office, and we see the hand going by. It leaves a long shadow on the wall.
It does.
Points right to Tim Robbins.
Mm-hmm.
It's a visual feast. There's a great performance for Buzz the Bellboy.
Jim True.
Okay, good.
Who was in Singles. If you remember Singles, he's the guy who's like, he's got 20 numbers. He's in Singles.
Yeah, he also goes on to be in The Wire.
Yeah.
As one of the guys on the special squad. He mm-hmm. is awesome in this movie. He's
yep.
a fast-talking bellhop. He eventually has his own idea of a circle.
Yeah.
It turns out to be for a bendy straw.
You know, for drinks.
and basically, Paul Newman discovers that this journalist has been acting as his secretary and writing all these bad articles. He finds out the newspaper is going to publish an article that outright says that Norval Barnes stole the hula hoop idea from Buzz the Bellhop,
mm-hmm.
which we know is not true. But at this point, there's no one that he can convince. She quits her job at the newspaper in defiance, tries to find him and cheer him up, but he now knows that she was lying to him. He leaves and off to have one of the worst evenings ever. He's already drunk. And I love when he says, when she shows up, he says, "Hey, this is a Pulitzer pool winner." he stumbles up the stairs and then Buzz the Bellhop sees him and then the whole mob chases him down the street in a what I can only call a Tom and Jerry type chase sequence.
Mm-hmm.
he ends up on the ledge himself contemplating jumping. Then he slips and falls, and he's dangling there, and then he eventually falls. And you think, oh, no. Right before he hits the ground, actually maybe 20, 30 feet up, he stops. And we cut back to the narrator, who's also the clock keeper of mm-hmm. this building, and he has wedged a broom handle into the clock, and it stopped the clock. And that actually has effectively stopped time. We see the ball desk toy in Paul Newman's office is frozen in his lap. He's frozen in his desk. And the guy says, now, strictly speaking, I'm not ever supposed to do this.
Yeah.
You have any other ideas? and then the dead Hudsucker comes down in angel form with yet another circle, a halo above
yep.
his head.
Yep.
And says the words, why didn't you deliver that blue letter? You might have learned something.
Mm-hmm.
And even having seen this movie so many times, I got so caught up in it this time. I was like, the blue letter, that's right. I forgot mm-hmm. how this ended. And the blue letter, of course, bequeaths all of the stock to whoever that board names president, which ends up being Norval Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
And the day is saved. he goes on to run a good company, and they do another circle doodle, and it turns out to be a frisbee.
Mm-hmm.
I love everything about this movie. I love the score. I love the visual mm-hmm. flair. I love the sets. I love the acting. Everybody's great. I can't imagine Clint Eastwood or Tom Cruise or anybody but Paul Newman and Tim Robbins in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's PG. I forgot this movie was rated PG.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's hear from Chris. What were your thoughts this time around?
The circle thing was something I kept a lot of tabs on during this one. The circle that forms around the future is now Shawshank. Hudsucker classified ad is the first circle that we see. Of course, he has the circle that he is going to eventually make the hula hoop. The clock itself is a circle. The halo's a circle. You can even say the story comes full circle because he is in the mailroom, and then by the end of it, he has to get his mailroom outfit back on to get the blue letter out and everything.
Yep.
There are so many moments of just purely just pure Coen Brothers comedy in this. Like, and just the way they shoot a movie a lot of times. Like, he's looking at those classified ads on those little boards outside and everything, and like all the images are like coming in, like, you know, like, what is, you know, experience. Yeah. And there's that whole thing too, where there's that whole, like, where the hula hoop is getting like approved through all these different processes and everything. And you see, like, you know, like all these like overlays of people stamping and stuff while it's doing, you have that, that moment, where, they're trying to come up with the name of what this is, which Sam Raimi is one of those people who's behind the glass trying to come up with the name for the hula hoop.
That's awesome.
But again, this movie, you know, as much as it focuses on Tim Robbins, and as much as it's amazing to see Paul Newman in it, this is Jennifer Jason Leigh's movie for me. Everything about this, about her performance in this movie, makes me fall in love with her, especially the scene where she's at her desk and she's talking to Smitty, played by Bruce Campbell. And there's a guy doing a puzzle, trying to work out a puzzle, crossword puzzle thing for the newspaper in the back, who keeps on throwing out this, like, what's a 10-letter word for this, and what's a 5-letter word for that, and so on and so forth. Yeah. She's talking to Smitty, to the guy doing that, and then gets on the phone and starts talking about what she's going to do with this story. And, you know, and she's like, let me tell you this, Smitty, here's the gravy, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, like, and she's sitting there, like, typing with this cigarette in her mouth and everything. I love the way that she says, you can consider this my resignation, and all that, like, when she's walking out and kicks that dude in the shins. I also love how they manipulate time in this. There's so many things in this that make it seem like, I don't know if the movie is literally saying this is happening all in a day. It's really just trying to tell you how fast things are going. Like, right. For instance, the hula hoop being sent to market, it's easy to say, oh, well, this all happened in one day, but I could literally say that this was a full, like, even though that's not, I don't think that's the time frame of the movie. The time frame of the movie is like a month, maybe, if that.
I think so. Yeah.
But you could literally say that whole sequence where the kid finds the hula hoop and everything might have been something like weeks, because consider what they're saying there. This guy put hula hoops on sale at his toy store, and he was so distraught that nobody bought this thing for kids during school that he was putting it. It got down to the point where the price went down to the point where it's like free with any purchase.
Yeah.
And then he throws them out, and then, yeah, you have this wunderkind who finds it on the sidewalk and stuff. To me, you could say that this is how a lot of products have issues with. They don't come out at the right time. Like, if this comes out in the summer, then the kids are all getting hula hoops and trying them out, and you get the Wonder Kid a lot faster. This one does say that this one does seem to say this all happened in a day, but I think the movie's kind of saying this may be weeks or something like that. Like, in a real world, it's just weeks that this takes.
Well, and he even says at the end, you know, you go to the top really, really fast, but the fall is always slow. And I forget the exact quote, but that sort of mirrors how the movie goes, because it all happens really fast. And then on his last worst day, we spend a bunch of it with him. New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
I love the language of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The Coens always have good language, good dialogue, but I love the old-timey correcting each other, like the 44 floors, 45, counting the mezzanine.
Yeah.
And then in the same conversation, it's 45 floors, no, 44, not counting the mezzanine.
Yeah.
And then later they're not even talking about the building floors, and the guy still brings the mezzanine into the conversation.
Yes.
At the very end, when he's trying to read this letter and he's struggling, of course he's hanging in the air, but Hudsucker keeps correcting him, because he says, fall.
Yeah.
It's fail. And he says, and if you fail, and he says, no, it's fall. It's just, I think there's just such a sharp focus on dialogue. It's not even 2 hours as a movie. I feel like it's just very tight. Everything was just very confident and tight. I love it.
Well, and yeah, you bring up a lot of the other, there's just general masters doing everything in this movie. You have Roger Deakins, who's always on the Coen Brothers movies, who's doing the cinematography. Carter Burwell, one of the best composers of all time, is doing the music, although they are using a known piece of music. I think it's called Adagio for Spartacus or something during this. But that just blends in with it. By the end of the movie, you're going to be like, there's going to be music in here that's just going to be in your head, especially like that Adagio for Spartacus is going to be in your head. The music that's playing during that whole like whirlwind thing where the hula hoop is getting approved and all that, you know, all that. So yeah, there's just a lot of masters working on this. And the mystery of this movie to me is that I know lots of people who do not like this at all, do not put this anywhere near the top of the Coen Brothers heap. The Coen Brothers set the bar pretty high. I mean, there's a lot of great movies, but there's some people I know who would put this at the bottom and not have any worries about it. And to me, I'm like, I just watched this again yesterday, and I have some nostalgia for it, but at the same time, like, how do you not see all the greatness that's in this movie? I don't understand it, you know? And to each his own, sure. Everybody can, you know, you can hate this movie if you want. It's just that I don't understand what you're seeing that is not good about this. Some people think Jennifer Jason Leigh is too over the top in this. Like she's trying for some sort of, you know, like that old 30s dialogue, that fast talking, whatever. But yeah, she does it to perfection. It works so well for this movie. I don't understand it. So anyway, yeah, I love it. I love it to pieces.
I love when he's insulting the author of the article, but he doesn't know it's the woman he's talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, why don't we get dinner and see a show? I was thinking The King and I. And she slaps him for all the shit he was saying about her being the author. And he goes, okay, how about Oklahoma?
Yeah. And you're talking about the elevator guy that when he gets on the elevator and he's like, going all the way to the top, okay buddy, or whatever, goes up to the next level, there's three people get on, and he's like, hello Mrs. Blah, you're number 17, you're number 20, and you're number 37. He goes, 36, walk down,
because he's doing rhymes. It's like, hey Kevin, you're 37, and that's the reason he wants to say that
more. Walk down. There's just a lot of, and it's funny, they put in Anna Nicole Smith playing basically what is Zsa Zsa Gabor in this. She's just Zsa Zsa in this or whatever, it's just funny seeing, of all the people back in the 1990s, who would you think would get into a Coen Brothers movie? You wouldn't think Anna Nicole Smith would be in one. It just shows their range of like knowledge and things that are out there, that you see these kind of characters, these kind of actors and whatever in it. It's just, I don't know, this movie's it's just a delight. It's such a delight.
Yes, I agree. Now, I got to find out what the double feature is going to be.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Okay. Before we get into the double feature, I will go over a few of the comments that were highlighted here. Apathy says, seeing the love for this movie spread is heartwarming. Yes, absolutely. Joseph says, that part where he's looking at the job board gave me flashbacks to job hunting. It's a starting job, but requires experience. Yeah, exactly. Jagged says, this so far is my favorite recommended movie on Wreckatopia. Well, there you go. It would be high on my list as well. Jagged says, I didn't realize Sam Raimi co-wrote the movie until Bruce Campbell showed up, and then I just assumed he did. Yeah. that's a super powerhouse that you're seeing there. I don't think they had collaborated this way since Crime Wave, and Crime Wave was not a really good movie. Sam Raimi directed that, and I think Coen's wrote it or whatever, but it was interesting to see them all collaborating on this one. Shaggy Nut says, best Coen movie. And then Castro says, wordplay is an underused art in comedy these days. Absolutely.
Indeed.
Okay, so my uh, My double feature here is goes along sort of the same lines in plotting. I was thinking of Mel Brooks, The Producers, for this. Mainly because the whole plot of that movie is a director and accountant want to come up with the worst possible play that they can come up with and make money based on people spending, you know, hoping that they're going to get a 100% profit back or whatever that they're never going to be able to pay back because they're not going to make the money that they think they're going to make. And of course, if the play is a hit, then they have a big problem because they have a huge amount of profits that they have promised to everybody.
There's a lot of parallel there, yeah.
So you know, as the producers has that, you know, that famous line, like, we picked the worst writer and we picked the worst director. Where did we go right? it's kind of like that. Like in Hudsucker Proxy, you know, look, I don't think the Coen brothers are saying the hula hoop is a genius invention of any sort. It does show you how lucky you have to be to get something to succeed a lot of times. And in this case, this is something that nobody would have ever cared about if not for, you know, this is not the real story of the hula hoop, but in this movie, this hula hoop doesn't do anything unless some kid runs across it in the sidewalk and is like instantly Mozart with it, you know? So like, and then it becomes a thing in front of a whole bunch of children and all the kids want it and everything. But yeah, The Producers was the movie that I thought of during this. I thought that was a big parallel, for this. So,
excellent.
Yeah. Which,
excellent. I was expecting you to say, but I didn't choose that because that's what we usually do. That reminds me, though, when you're talking about the hula hoop scene, reminds me of that Simpsons episode with the yo-yos, where everybody wants a yo-yo.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, everybody wants a yo-yo.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right. I like that. That is an excellent double feature. And I think even some of the tone. Not just the parallel story ideas, but I think they're similar in tone. All right. Now, what about homework for next week? What's the big recommend?
All right. So we have a, you know, October is going to be our next few episodes. I don't know how it's going to go, but I do want to get at least one horror movie in, and one that I don't think many people talk about that much. It is 1980s, The Changeling. Nice. With George C. Scott. This movie doesn't get a lot of play in the horror realm. Like it feels like people kind of overlook this. And I haven't seen this in forever, so who knows? Maybe again, like, you know, we always take our chances with a movie we haven't seen in forever. But I remember loving The Changeling when I last saw it, which was back in the 90s somewhere. But I remember there being a lot of creepy stuff in this.
I've seen the Angelina Jolie one,
which is a completely different,
movie. Remake?
Yeah, it's just called Changeling, and and Angelina Jolie has a kid, and the kid is like kidnapped or something like that, and then they bring back another kid, and it's not her kid, and she is like swearing up and down to people in the government that it's not her kid, and they're like, ah, screw you, you're just a dame, blah blah blah, you know, that type of thing. This movie is a horror movie, and it has nothing to do with that Angelina Jolie movie, although the Angelina Jolie movie's pretty good actually overall,
but I liked it. By the way, folks listening, the Changeling, the 1980 version, or I guess it's the only version, I'm going to tell you all the services you can find it. It's on Plex, it's on Vudu, it's on Tubi. It's on a P with a bunch of colored circles next to it. I don't know what that is. Is that Peacock? I don't know what that one is. It's on the Roku channel if you have a premium subscription. It's on Amazon Prime if you have it is Peacock if you have a premium subscription. And it's on Peacock. Lots of places to find this one for free if you're willing to watch some commercials, and even a couple places for free, no commercials.
And you said you've seen this?
I've not. No. I was thinking it was connected to the Jolie film, and I would have at least some concept, but no, I've never seen this. I'm excited to watch this.
Yeah, and once again, I'll remind everybody, because we did talk about the Angelina Jolie movie a little bit. This is 1980. George C. Scott horror movie, not the Angelina Jolie movie. So just keep that in mind. You are going to type in Changeling into your various streaming services, and that Angelina Jolie movie will come up. Watch the George C. Scott 1980.
Yes. Movie. Don't be fooled by Angelina Jolie. Also, I think we're both planning to pick horror or horror adjacent stuff for October.
Mm-hmm.
We are trying to set up an interview with an old friend
mm-hmm.
that we interviewed on a previous podcast. And that will be in October and won't be really about a horror movie. But I'm excited to watch this one, and I'm excited to pick my next October-related one. Okay,
absolutely.
So let's do a couple questions. What do you say?
Yeah, questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
this is a long one. In 50 First Dates, Lucy makes her dad and brother watch The Sixth Sense every day because she has no memory of the day before, and they have to sit there and pretend to be surprised that Bruce Willis was Kaiser Soze the whole time. What movie would you love to watch every day with someone who was discovering it for the first time? Conversely, what movie would drive you batshit insane if you had to watch it every day?
Well, obviously, I'm going to give them Back to the Future. I'll watch that every day. In fact, I did that a long time ago, watch Back to the Future every day. But Back to the Future would be a great one. The Prestige is one that I would love to see somebody watch for the first time a bunch. Mm. If there was a crazy I was thinking about the spirit of that question. Like, obviously, you wouldn't want to see anything bad. But is there a movie that's good that you wouldn't want to see every day that would drive you crazy? And I was thinking something along the lines of My Dinner with Andre or Primer. Those would be those type of movies that you wouldn't want to watch every day. Because they're good, but, you know, it's like, I don't want it every day. And I can't have that every day. Man. So
I would say for the one that I would want to watch every day, either Iron Giant, because it's just so damn perfect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or The Matrix, because I did get to watch my niece and nephew see The Matrix for the first time when they were teenagers, and it was awesome. And it's also my favorite movie, so I wouldn't mind watching that every day. On the flip side, I think any Darren Aronofsky film.
Oh, yeah.
Just because they're so fucking depressing, even though most of them are excellent. Requiem for a Dream, Black Swan, The Wrestler. If I had to watch any of those every day, I would be in such a bad headspace.
Mm-hmm.
It would just be awful.
Yeah.
What do some of the commenters have to say? Any good ideas over there?
It says, 8 says The Prestige, aping my own pick there. That Weta says Princess Bride. I love showing that one to people. Yeah, Princess Bride would be great.
Yeah.
Movie I'd love, The Martian. Movie I'd hate, Dumb and Dumber. Yeah. Passion of the Christ, not watching that again, though I thought it was good. Yeah, that would definitely not be something that you would want to watch over and over. Jet Smith says, the movie that would drive me insane would be The Ring. Yeah, for sure. Mm. And then Polly says, even movies I like, I don't want to see it like every day for a long time. Imagine watching Audition. Yeah, Audition would be a tough one to watch over and over again, for sure.
All right, another question. What's the best score from a bad movie?
Lady in the Water seems to have a pretty good score. Lady in the Water is a James Newton Howard score. The movie itself, I mean, that's M. Night at his deepest, up his own ass he's ever been, is Lady in the Water. And it's one of those movies where it's like, you can tell that somebody who really loves movies is making it behind the camera, but it's just, it's such a slog. But the music itself, I can take. Lady in the Water is good. Mm. So
that's a good call. Mm. I've only seen that movie twice, and I don't think I want to watch it enough to know the score, but I might give the score itself a listen. I chose Waterworld, which I don't personally even consider a bad movie, but society does, and I'll agree with them. But I love this movie, but I could sing that. Dun, 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 dun. I love it. It's like piratey and an adventure-y, and there's a lot of other good things about Waterworld, but it doesn't equal a good whole. But the score is not a problem.
Yeah.
I heard that Kevin Costner actually took over for the composer and wrote the
score. He probably did. Actually, Edward Norton did. You didn't realize that Edward Norton took over. Over on the comments, Joseph says, Raise the Titanic is a score I like. Movie's not great. Jets Met says, Batman Forever, although that may be more soundtrack than, well, score's pretty good. Score's pretty
still
good.
Still rules, though.
Yeah. Soundtrack's
I
great.
I had that album.
Yeah. Monday says, Toy Story 4 is literally the worst movie Pixar ever made. Hey, you take that back. It's Cars 2. but Newman is trying so hard, to be honest. Yes. Yes, he definitely is. Jagged Pirates of the Caribbean 2 through 5 have amazing scores. And I believe that's Hans Zimmer. Who's doing Pirates of the Caribbean, although it could be Hans Zimmer and somebody else, or somebody who's like under Hans Zimmer or something, like one of those type of things. Hans Zimmer these days, like a lot of times it's like, that's a Hans Zimmer score, and then you find out it's Hans Zimmer and somebody or something.
Especially some of the Snyder stuff.
Yeah.
It's like Hans Zimmer and then it'd be like a DJ name or something. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
What's that Captain Death or whoever did the score for, I don't know his name, but the Batman v Superman.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I can't remember.
I'm not even going to Google it.
Yeah.
let's do another one. Good movie that most people seem to either have never seen or forgotten about. This is the premise of this podcast in many, many cases. But
yeah, pretty
what
much.
What do you got here?
I've said this a million times, but the one I feel very few people have seen is Zero Effect. And I try to espouse that movie as much as I can. However, you know, it may be hard to find these days, and who knows? I don't know. People may not like it as much when they see it, but I think the one movie that people have forgotten about that is great and probably should have won Best Picture in 1997, L.A. Confidential. I don't seem to hear much about L.A. Confidential anymore. It seems like a lot of movies from the 90s have gotten their resurrections and everything, but LA Confidential has sort of been one of those that's just top of the line excellent that people have just forgotten about. So I've even thought about making LA Confidential a big recommend at some point, but I've been trying to gauge whether or not it was a movie that nobody's talking about, or if it is and I'm just not seeing that conversation. So by the way, somebody said Junkie XL is the guy who's been Thank doing you. Music with
yeah. Captain Death.
Captain Death, AKA Captain Death.
I think eventually, if this show goes long enough, my answer is one that I will make a big recommend, and it's 1998's Safe Men with Steve Zahn and Sam Rockwell and Paul Giamatti, where a couple of crappy musicians and singers get mistaken for expert safe crackers and get mixed up with the mob and the Stanley Cup. It's one of my favorite underrated films that people, I know one person besides you who has ever talked about this movie with me. And the rest of the world just doesn't seem to know it exists. So that's my answer.
Over in the comments, Jet Smet says 1114. It's a movie with Patrick Swayze. I've never even heard of it. Shaggy Nut says Time Cop, which is, I know, is a big one on your list of, like all time kind of like, you know, fun movies that, you know, people
that
don't really.
That is also batshit insane. Yes.
Right. Is Ouija Shark a thing, or am I just reading this incorrectly? Or is it just Ouija? Is it just Ouija? I don't know. I can't quite tell based on that.
I hope there's a movie called Ouija Shark.
I hope so too. If there's not, go to Tubi. There you probably find one. That Ouija says Out of Sight is amazing and not enough people have seen it. Very, very correct. Castro says Hoodwinked. Yes.
I've heard this.
Hoodwinked is really good.
I've never seen it.
It's like a little Red Riding Hood cartoon that's sort of
Shrekified.
Kind of Shrekified, but not as annoying as Shrek, I don't think. I believe Anne Hathaway is the voice of Little Red Riding Hood in that movie. Equilibrium, great choice, is another
that
one.
Is
yes,
an awesome choice.
Yeah.
I love that.
All of those are good. So.
Yeah. All right. Let's do one more, and then we'll wave goodbye.
All right.
What is the most recent interesting movie factoid that you have learned?
I mean, I actually gave it away during the Pearl recommendation. The fact that they went to Australia and they had to have a 2-week quarantine where they were sitting there waiting for all of that to get done. And in the middle of all that decided, hey, let's write the prequel to this movie before we even make this movie. And then they got it greenlit before they even made made X. That is astounding to me.
That's absurd.
It's such a great story, and to have done that, and then just make the movie while you're out there, and it's just happens to be great when they get it done. So
I have two. One I didn't write down. I love the factoid I learned several months ago about the end of Free Guy, where they use the Captain America shield and the lightsaber being shot after the bulk of the movie. Fox had been acquired by Disney, and Ryan Reynolds and the director went to whoever and said, hey, now that we're all the same company, can we use a couple of Disney and MCU stuff at the end of this movie? And it's one of the best moments of the whole film.
Yeah.
And it just occurred to Ryan Reynolds. And then another one I just read last week is that almost all of the night scenes in Jordan Peele's Nope were shot in broad-ass daylight.
Yeah, that's insane.
Because they basically invented a new lens that uses different infrared wavelengths. And I read about it, and I still don't know what they did, but I think it's going to change a lot of things in cinema in terms of... Because you can't shoot with kids after a certain hour.
Yeah.
So imagine you're making a movie like Goonies, and now you can just fake night. Because I'm usually really good at seeing when they shot in daylight and then just darkened it in post. But that's not what happened here. They used a special lens. I couldn't have told you that any of those scenes were shot in the daytime. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, any factoids in the...
Chris Batkinson says, did you know that when Viggo Mortensen kicked the helmet, and he ... it, because that's one of those all time, like everybody. Yes, he actually broke his toes when he kicked that helmet, and he continued with the scene. Amazing. Way to go, Viggo. Joseph says, it's not exactly cool, but I was surprised that Dolph Lundgren put Sly Stallone in the ICU in the Rocky movie he's in. So yeah, totally. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Wreckatopia. Next week is The Changeling. Remember to not confuse it with the Angelina Jolie movie. Watch the George C. Scott movie. It was a pleasure having everybody on the comments again and Twitch and YouTube. Thank you so much for coming out and making the place lively around here.
We will see you
next time. See ya.
Goodbye. Bye.
Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter @CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@CinemaSins.com. That's RECOTOPIA @CinemaSins.com.
Da-da-da-da-da.
I was like, it kind of fucked Wanda a bit in this movie. She kind of like by the end of the WandaVision, it's like, oh, she went through some trials and tribulations. She made it through. She's grown as a character. And then of course they had this little, you know, stinger at the end of the show. Like if you watch till the end of the credits, where it's like, oh, there may still be some evil in that Wanda. And it's all setting up Doctor Strange basically. And it's like, it seems kind of like, yeah, I don't know. Why'd we go through all of this? Why did she go through all of this only just to be evil again for this movie? Like, why couldn't she just be evil at the end of the show and then she could have her growth?
What's crazy is she's phenomenal in these movies. Mm-hmm. She's great in this role.
Yeah.
But they have never given me anything to care about with this character. Mm-hmm. Like, her and Vision fell in love, like, to the depths of the ocean.
Makes no sense. Yeah.
And I'm supposed to be all cut up inside when Vision dies and she's upset, and I'm not. I feel like Thanos. I'm like, I don't even know who you are.
And you needed you needed something like WandaVision to get you into the point where you were like, oh, they do really love each other and everything, but like nothing exactly. In the movie said that. You know, that was to me, that was Hermione and Ron all over again. Yes. That was like, no, I insist they are in love. So you should therefore think they are in love as well. And I'm like, okay. Say, did you see any of that Alan Rickman diary stuff that was on Twitter?
Yes. I mean, it doesn't sound, first of all, my first question is how does this happen?
Yeah. Same.
The man has been dead and somebody finds this and what, leaks it? That seems really rude.
It's really, really sketch. Yeah.
Unless it's like his direct, you know, next of kin, and he had written authorization. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I highly doubt he'd be like, hey, by the way, tell people that I didn't want to be in Harry Potter after the second movie.
Tell people how little I thought of Emma Watson's accent.
Right.
I mean, it's not quite as scandalous as the headlines made it seem.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's interesting because his feelings about Harry Potter seem to have evolved and changed mm-hmm. over the course of making 8 movies to where he almost seems really proud of it by the end. I'm going to tell my wife after I get off of here, don't release my private writing mm-hmm. after I'm dead.
Mm-hmm.
Don't
yep.
do it.
Yep.
Because if I wanted that shit out there, I would have published it myself.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like most of the people he mentions by name, like Emma Watson or Daniel Radcliffe, are mature enough at this point to take that all in stride. And I'm sure they had a solid relationship with him.
We were just kids and we were stupid kids and, you know. All that.
He's almost his character from Galaxy Quest.
He's exactly his character from Galaxy Quest.
In that he's like, I did Hamlet on this British, loyal British stage.
Yeah.
Got 3 curtain calls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel about the starting extra innings with the player on second base?
In general, I like it.
Yeah. Because it leads to more action.
Yeah, and the home team already had an advantage anyway, being sudden death and everything. But I don't know. I don't know if the intended purpose of it, which was to shorten games, is actually happening. Because I mean. Yes, there would be some games once in a blue moon. You'd get something that would go 18 innings or something like that, which is insane. But I don't think it happened often enough I don't know. In general, I like it because it does. I don't know. Are they doing that in the postseason, though? I'm not sure if they're doing it in the postseason.
I don't think so.
It's kind of like the NHL and their shootout and everything.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the shootout. Yeah. So I think that's fine. I think it's fine in regular season. In postseason, no, I don't think it's fine because far and away the home team has the advantage there.
And as they should in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I saw it was really jarring because I hadn't seen enough baseball or read enough to know that they had continued doing that after the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I was like, I went out of the room during a commercial and came back and the O's had a guy on second and I was like, whoa, double. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see how that happened. And I looked up the game and it did not say a double. It said, what was the first?
Started at second or something or whatever.
Yeah. Like, it's an I word inserted or anyway.
Yeah. It's always the, whoever was last at bat goes there. The, Seattle Mariners might be fun to watch too.
Are they good? I didn't know.
They are. They are good. Kind of came out of nowhere last year. Started getting really good and even lost a couple of guys from last year. And but then they got Julio Rodriguez this year, and they're still good. Mariners are still good.
Ichiro's still kicking it around.
He's yeah. no, but he shows up now and then. He showed up at that special game where like the girl who got the foul ball from him 10 years ago.
I saw that.
Yeah, threw out the first pitch, and they had a whole Ichiro girl game.
I can think of worse things to be famous for.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Like girl who chugs a beer at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, 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 exactly. So
I mean, she seems to be enjoying it.
Oh, she that's one of the most genuine reactions ever caught on a broadcast.
I'm ready to get this show on the
road. Let's shoot this fucker.